Stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today I'm playing an interview I did with Clyde Compton, who's assistant to Gordon Greenfield, who directed Yentl for the 2012 Oslo Repertory Theatre season. If you were listening last week, you heard my interview with Greg Lemming, who directed God of Carnage, but I didn't have enough time to play Sharon Leslie's review, so I'll be leading off with that today. So hang on, here come the show. Self-knowledge. Maybe that sounds, I don't know, a little heavy. But as a psychotherapist, I have discovered in my more than 30 years of private practice that people quite often come into therapy trying to become something they already are, but they don't know it. They don't know it because their childhood had forced them to pretend that it wasn't so. And so so many of us live lives of distance from our real selves. And of course, that doesn't feel good. Even if your capacity for denial is really strong and you have no idea that there are these things inside of you which you are not using, don't have access to, are not taking advantage of, even if you don't actually know it, you don't feel quite right. You feel out of sync, and that's of course because you are out of sync. And many of us go through our entire lives yearning for qualities that we already have, but which we not only don't have access to, but are reluctant to admit, even when we are yearning for them. So I have dozens of examples of people who come into adulthood feeling shy or timid or unable to confront the new kind of language, right? They never assert themselves, or they're independent to a fault and can never ask anyone for help, and think that when they seem to be needing help, that is a sign of weakness and they can't tolerate that or bear it. Or the other way around, people who just always need help. They are always sort of in need, you know, needy, 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 and they can't find the core inside of themselves where they are self-sufficient. And it's been my experience that these people pretty much always have those qualities inside them. But the circumstances of their childhood, and I'm not going to go into those right now, made it undesirable for them to demonstrate those qualities. So I wrote a book about this. It's called When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. And you can read that by going up on my website, thelynneshow.com, thelynneshow, and click on email me and say I want the book. That you can also hear in my shows, in many of my shows, I talk about the concepts in the book, and they are in the earlier shows, and you can listen to the shows by going up on the website. The other thing that I do in my shows is I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And as I said in the lead-in today, I am doing an interview with Clyde Compton, who was assistant to Gordon Greenfield, who's the director who directed Yentl for the Oslo Repertory Theater 2012 season. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art because in order to do that, it has to be who you really are. We make it so hard for people to make a life of an art in this culture that it has to be the truth about you. Having said that, not everybody simply knows it. And in Clyde Compton, we have a very, very interesting story of a guy who discovered his interest in acting and later in directing in a very unique way, which I'm not going to give away. I'm going to let Clyde tell his story. If you were listening last week, you heard my interview with Greg Lemming, who directed God of Carnage, also playing now in repertory at the Oslo Repertory Theater. And if you were listening to the lead-in to the show, you know that I'm going to take the opportunity today to play Sharon's review. And I'm going to lead off with Sharon's review, and then I'm going to play my interview with Clyde Compton. So here is Sharon Leslie's review of the extraordinary production of God of Carnage. With a title like God of Carnage, you may think that blood will be drawn sometime during the performance of this Tony Award-winning play by French playwright Yasmina Reza, currently playing at the Oslo Repertory Theater. But the only real blood is delivered offstage by two children on a playground in an incident that is only talked about on stage. More enjoyable is watching this four-person comedy pack 90 minutes of shifting tensions, alliances, and revelations that undress the overcoat of civilization professed by each of the characters, barely covering naked dog-eat-dog urges. Filled with ironic and physical humor, it's a gem of a piece for four fine actors. The changing battlefronts are skillfully drawn in what might be called a comedy of manners for the middle class. Sometimes the battle is us against them, sometimes men against women, and sometimes the economic David versus Goliath. In the sleek, contemporary living room of Veronica and Michael, the grown-ups are discovered discussing how Alan and Annette's son has broken two teeth of the other couple's son with a stick. coffee, and homemade clafouti are served as art books are admired. Alan is on edge because of his cell phone calls that interrupt the attempts at a congenial assignation of blame, responsibility, and apologies for the boys. We, the audience, know that it's only a matter of time before this smoking volcano erupts, and it does. Be prepared for projectile vomiting, which may sound off-putting but turns out to be highly theatrical. It is the signal that we are about to watch the nauseating behavior by adults that will make the childish playground behavior seem small. How can all of this be funny? That's the genius of the piece. The Oslo has mounted a riveting production showcasing four fine performances. David Breitbarth is highly watchable as he goes from caring husband and father to Neanderthal to emotional brawler and back again. James Clark is marvelous as the overbearing corporate lawyer with his occasional lapses of empathy, intent on wringing as much out of each situation for himself. As Veronica, the self-appointed arbiter of correctness, Kate Hampton plays the contrasts in her character admirably. She begins with a nice calm voice and demeanor which eventually reaches comically screaming pitches. Katie Cunningham, a third-year FST conservatory student, holds her own against the other excellent actors. Direction by Greg Lemming is smart and crisp, mostly getting out of the way of these fine actors so they can shine. The set is stunning, the costumes appropriate, the play holds surprises and fun twists. While the characters are drained by the end of the Battle of Manners, the audience is thoroughly entertained. God of Carnage runs through April 6th. And that is a review by Sharon Leslie. I'm sure that listening to Sharon's review of God of Carnage makes you want to run right out and see it, and as you should. It is a delightful ride in the theater. And hopefully what Clyde Compton says about Yentl will have the same impact on you. So here now is my interview with the delightful Clyde Compton. I am here with Clyde Compton, who is ably assisting Gordon Greenberg, who is directing Yentl for the Oslo Repertory Theater.
That's right.
Okay, good. I do an internet radio show for which I interview people who make their living or their life within art.
Hmm.
And clearly, anyone who is doing what you're doing is in hopes of doing that.
Yes, definitely.
Okay, good. So I always ask the same question.
I would love to answer them.
There's only one. Well, there's two, but the second one will come later.
Great.
The first one is, since directing seems to be what you're leaning towards,
yes,
when was the very first moment in your life that it occurred to you that directing was interesting, attractive, compelling, a possibility?
Right.
Okay?
Oh, yes. So I've been in theater since I was, 12,
mm-hmm.
which is actually fairly late for most theater kids. Everyone says that since they were toddlers, they were always on stage. But I started a little late than most theater kids, and I got into acting, of course.
Yes.
I think a lot of people get into acting.
Okay, but if you got in at 12,
yeah,
when was the first suggestion? You're going
yeah,
there.
Yeah,
you don't
yeah,
need
yeah.
me to direct.
Oh no, yes,
you.
Yeah, I'm good. I've told this story.
Oh, okay.
So from 12 all the way into college, I was an actor.
Right.
And then one day, we had a...
Oh, no, wait. Because what you didn't say, and maybe I didn't make this clear, is what made... What triggered the acting?
Oh, well, there was a girl that I liked that was doing one of the plays.
Really?
And so I joined theater to meet this girl, and theater is always full of beautiful women.
Yes.
Beautiful men, too.
Yes.
But tons of beautiful women, and they're usually very, very smart.
Mm-hmm.
Which is also a plus. So that's what attracted me first to the theater.
This is lovely. Where did you grow up?
San Antonio, Texas. San
Antonio, a lot of Texas. Theater in San Antonio?
A lot of little theater in San Antonio. And I think a huge thing in Texas, surprisingly, is the high school one-act plays.
Really?
Every high school sends a group of kids to go compete every year. And there are zones, districts, areas, regions, and then there's a statewide competition upheld by UT, University of Texas at Austin. And you can win a full ride scholarship to UT.
Oh my goodness.
You can win thousands of dollars.
So what is the competition for the actors or for the plays?
It's for the students. It's for the students and of course the teachers who direct them.
Right.
And it's really to keep theater alive.
There. Amazing.
Because without it, there is no huge professional theater in San Antonio. There's a Roadhouse and there's about 12 community theaters.
Right.
But there's no huge professional theater like the Oslo here.
Right.
Or any other big theater, like the Actors Theater of Louisville in Kentucky. A bunch of people in the cast are from there, and they grew up watching those shows.
Yes.
But, like, I didn't get to grow up watching those shows.
No, it's real interesting, though, that somebody in Texas thought it was useful, important,
yes,
necessary to do this.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of money attached to
this.
Yes,
it is.
Right. Okay, so is that what you got into at 12, or?
No, at 12 I got into, the high school one is the huge one for everyone. And then there's a middle school one. Because
12, because you're not even in high school yet, right.
Because that helps you get ready to be in the high school.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, and I was lucky enough to, I went to an inner city school, so not a lot of money, but we had a fine arts magnet academy, where if you wanted to study art, you could go there. And that school was built in 1933 to relieve work from the Depression.
Mm-hmm.
And so the name of the school is Thomas Jefferson High School, and it's the first million-dollar school in the nation, actually. And it looks like a little college.
Mm-hmm.
And I got to go there, and I studied acting.
So now, wait. So you're in middle school.
Yes.
You're like sixth or seventh grade or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you see this girl, and you think, I'd really like to get to know this girl.
Yes.
And she's in this play, or she's in drama class,
mm-hmm,
or what?
She's in, her mother noticed that I liked her. And, because her mother was very involved with the school. She worked at the school. And she went to Mrs. Brown and said, hey, I have a perfect actor for you.
Really?
Yeah. Well, I guess because I was really loud, I guess. And
you think that's it?
That
you
were,
she,
I suppose
this is,
so.
This is a very sweet thing and also an ironic thing.
Isn't
I mean,
it?
That a mother should be even noticing that some little boy likes her daughter and then wanting to facilitate that in some
way.
I think she realized...
She could push her daughter. Who she could? She wasn't going to be able to keep her daughter from boys. So at least
she could pick one
that was nice.
Yeah. Oh, that's hilarious!
Isn't that funny?
Yes.
Kind of scary, but oh well.
Well, but I mean, you know, I'm thinking, you know, oh, but for the want of a nail, the shoe was lost, and the want of a
I mean,
my
the
God.
Parade of Horribles. That's what that is.
Is that what that is?
That's the Parade of Horribles. I studied Little Law, so.
I didn't know that was what it was called, but it's like this ironic little twist of fate,
mm-hmm,
that this woman...
And so the kingdom was lost.
And we have a director.
Yeah, I guess.
You know?
No, I for that, I actually believe it. It has
so
to
do
be.
I.
Yeah.
Yeah, so do I. That's why I'm saying it's... And these are the sort of things that I always want to find. You know, where is the twist of fate? Where is the thing that couldn't have happened or might not or shouldn't have happened or... You know, under other circumstances, wouldn't have happened.
Right.
So this is... Okay, so we... Do you remember either one of their name, the mother or the daughter?
Oh, yeah. Well, definitely the daughter. She was the first girl I ever really, really... my heart felt I loved.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah Lauren Hinojosa. And she's actually in New York. She just graduated about a year or two from Sarah Lawrence,
mm-hmm,
which is a fairly good school. And I think she's doing work up there in New York.
So you still know about
Oh, yeah,
her
we're friends on Facebook, yeah. Isn't that fun?
Okay, so Mrs. Hinojosa.
Yes, Mrs.
In a sense, we owe all of this to Mrs. Hinojosa.
To Amanda, yes.
Amanda, exactly,
Amanda.
Right. Okay,
yes.
So Amanda goes to Mrs. Brown, who I assume is the director of the play or something.
Yes, she's an English teacher.
Right, and she says, I have an actor for you, and it's Clyde.
And...
What do you think of this?
Well, I was wary at first, and I was crazy about Sarah. But before then, I was in basketball and football, and
you were a boy.
Yeah, I was a boy.
Right.
I was a real boy.
Yes.
And so I went to show up to Mrs. Brown and say, maybe I can't. Maybe. And
maybe this is not such a good idea.
And she said, oh, look, you just came right in time. Everyone here in the play is here. Come meet everyone. And so I got stuck.
Yes, right. Oh, my God.
But after
stuck
that.
Stuck with your destiny.
Yeah. And after that, I don't know. I guess I didn't understand that there's a... I never learned how to do any of those things. I just did them.
Yes.
Like, hey, pretend to be this person and interact with the other people. It's like, okay.
So you had a kind of natural...
I did.
Yes.
And it was nice because I just... it's interesting. You probably can't tell right now, but... you see how there's a bump here?
Yes, I do.
And you see how there's, like, no bump here?
Yes, I see. Did we break something?
I fractured my wrist, and so I wasn't able to play any of the sports.
Oh, my goodness.
And so, like, that gave me something to do.
Yes. Not only did it fill the time, mm-hmm. but it gave you some place to be...
Yeah, a community.
Yes,
something. And,
yes.
And it's actually... It's theater has this... beautiful community.
Yes.
So I didn't realize that community that started there would, like, it's still here. It's still here now in this professional theater.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah. I've heard lots of people say, actually people who didn't have a place to be before they discovered theater, you know, who felt like misfits or outcast or whatever, and then they found the drama class or the drama club, and suddenly they found a place,
a family,
a family.
Home.
Exactly.
Yes.
So I have tears in my eyes. I do, because I think it's so true. And, you know, we make it so hard for actors in this world.
We do.
And so, but they get something that a lot of people in this world never experience, is a sense of belonging to something.
Yes.
You know?
Larger than them, yeah.
Yeah. Okay, good. So now we have you. Do you remember the play?
Shut and Bar the Door. Shut and Bar the Door is a farce. It was about a husband and a wife, and they were tired of it was a spat. It was like it became the old, why haven't you picked up your socks, when the argument isn't about the socks.
Right.
And their argument was, would you shut the door? Would you shut and bar the door?
Yeah, right.
And a prince comes in, a princess comes in, I think a fairy comes in. It's this wild thing, and by the end, the husband relents, and he
closes
shuts
the door.
Well, shut and bar. No, an audience member, one of the kids in the play was an audience member, and so she walked in, and she, I'll close the door, and so we broke the fourth wall. It was fun. We won. We won that year.
Ooh, yeah. Congratulations.
We
okay,
did really
great.
Well.
Okay, so now we have you at 12, having discovered that acting... is a thing you like, a thing you're drawn to, and so
my family's horrified.
Yes, of course. They'd rather have had a basketball player.
Yes, exactly.
Right.
Or even, I was a pretty good writer, and I was, they pushed me towards a writing high school where I could learn, I could, you know, meet all of the giants and become a good writer, maybe write for the newspaper, maybe do
something
that's artistic, but... has some, I don't know, ground.
Legitimacy.
Yes, some legitimacy.
Right. Not acting.
No, not acting.
Yeah.
And I think throughout high school, they were a little wary of it, and it was something I did, along with keeping up my good grades.
Good boy.
So that I could become a lawyer. Or I could become a doctor.
Yes. Something to fall back on.
Yes. I have always entertained those things.
To be a lawyer?
I was studying for the LSAT this summer.
In case.
Just to take it, yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Did you?
I did not. I did not because I got two jobs, and it did not give me enough time mm-hmm. to do them.
And you chose the jobs.
I chose the jobs.
Yeah. Well, it's not too late. The LSAT's not going anywhere.
No, it's not going anywhere. It's not going anywhere, and it'll always be there. I also wanted to be a neurologist. Because I love Oliver Sacks and his case studies.
Oh
my goodness. And I just can't stand blood. So, like, there's 3 or 4 years in there that you have to go to the hospital. Well, as soon as this peters out, then I'll do that.
That is so wonderful. Often, people that I interview say, well, if I have to, then I suppose I can find something else to do. You know?
Right.
I almost never hear... there are so many things I could do. This is great, and I love this, but if it's not this, then it could be something else I would love.
Right.
You're very lucky. Okay, so from 12 to 30, I believe you started to tell me, you thought it was acting.
Yes, I was, so I was in college, and I was lucky enough to go to a small liberal arts college where I got lots of attention.
And majoring in?
Majoring in drama.
Mm-hmm.
I went in with poli-sci.
Always covering your ass.
Yes, always. Well, you got to, just in case.
Yeah, I got it.
And
anyway, your parents.
And, well, by then.
Oh, they'd seen you.
I had a scholarship for, a scholarly scholarship for, like, having good grades. And I had mentioned in passing to one of my professors that, hey, I was thinking about becoming a full poli-sci major and, like, focusing there, maybe, and becoming a theater minor. And within a couple of weeks, they offered me a scholarship through the theater, because I did not audition to be in the theater department there. And so theater helped pay for my education. I got to go to school for free.
Ah, because the theater department paid for your education,
yes.
So you could minor in poli-sci.
I could minor in poli-sci. Right. And then I dropped poli-sci and I minored in philosophy.
Oh, my goodness.
But it was okay. My parents, my mother and sister were, like, completely fine with it just because, well, if it's paying for him to go to college.
Yeah,
he's
really,
doing,
how bad can this be?
He's doing something right.
Right,
yes.
Right.
So I did that for, yeah, so I was in a bunch of plays for a long time, and my junior year, the end of my junior year, we had a Skype session
mm-hmm.
with the artistic director of the Riverside Shakespeare Festival in Winona, and he told us, I asked him, I said, when did you decide you were a director? Because I was taking the directing class, and I was really enjoying it. And he said, I love the rehearsal process. I love playing, I love changing things, I love experimenting, but performance was, because sometimes it's a hit or miss, and sometimes the audience, you're not connected, but when you are, it's great, but it's not for me. And I thought, that is me.
Yeah.
That is me all of the time.
Right.
And I talked to my mentor, Dr. Robert Ball, and he was like, yeah, that sounds like you. I was like, so I'm a director, and he was like, he's like, oh yeah. But I'm not gonna tell you that,
right?
Because I was so set on being an actor.
Yeah.
And so, like, if someone has dreams, he wasn't gonna, like, destroy them. He was gonna let me discover it myself. And so I think I'm actually fairly lucky that I discovered directing earlier than a lot of my directing peers. Because there are directors now; they're gonna be great directors that are gonna pan out in the next 20 years who are actors right now.
Yes. Yes. Every director I've interviewed started as an actor.
Which is good.
Yeah.
Which is good because then you can understand and connect and talk with those actors.
Yes. You know what it feels like to be on the other side.
Yes, you do. Because there are directors who have not acted.
I haven't talked to them, though.
Yeah, and they understand story different. I mean, they're more objective.
Yes, yes.
But they don't understand, they can't talk to the actor as well. They don't understand beats and emotions as well. But they do understand story, which is the most important thing. That's something I had to learn. Because as an actor, your job, as textbooks have it, is that your job is to tell the story, your part of the story. And as a director, your job is to tell the entire story with these actors. So actors create moments, and directors create scenes.
I'm doing a kind of little series of the Oslo directors are all here.
Yeah, yeah. There's a great handful of them.
I know, and yeah. And so I want to ask you
mm-hmm.
To talk a little bit about what, well, because you've already begun to do it, to talk a little bit about what your feelings about directing are. Now, have you had an opportunity to direct on your own and not
yes.
just to be, yeah, so talk to me about what one might call your philosophy of directing or the what you're trying to do, or
sure, no,
okay?
Yeah, that makes sense. So my first directing job, my first real, I'd even say professional kind of job was that. This is when I was studying for the LSAT. Actually, I was in the library. I had just graduated from college. Had a couple of family issues arise, so I did not have a job that summer in theater. But I was bored. So I was studying for the LSAT, And I got a call from my mentor, Dr. Robert Ball, and he said, hey, we need someone to direct the first show of the year. And I said, you don't want to get somebody else? He said, well, we called you, and then we called some other guy, and he was up for it, and then he petered out, so we're calling you back again before we call anybody else.
Wow.
And because there are other directors in San Antonio, and I guess he was trying to do me a solid. He was trying to do me a favor, but I guess also he knew that I wasn't bad.
Oh, I'm quite sure he wasn't going to risk.
Right.
Right?
Yes. Well, yeah, it's his department.
That's right, yeah. So while it may very well be true that he was trying to do something for you, he wasn't doing something for you at his expense.
Exactly. No, yes, you're right. Mm-hmm. You're right.
So what was the play and what happened?
The play was Jack and Jill, a romance. It's actually a play that premiered in the, I think, 1999 or 1997 Humana Festival in the Actors Theater of Louisville. And that was done by Jane Martin and directed by John Jory. You might want to look John Jory and Jane Martin up because there's an interesting story about who really is the playwright.
Really?
Yeah. And so you might want to look that up. It's really interesting. I've actually just applied to the Actors Theatre of Louisville. I'll probably be working there next year.
Oh,
I'm really
yay.
Excited.
Okay.
Excited. So yes, that was the play. It was a two-person play that used the backstage hands. It brought them all to the front of the stage, and they all dressed in black. And instead of having scene changes that, like, the lights would go off and the scene would change, they would just walk on stage during parts of the scene.
Wow.
And the world would change during the scene, and then we would continue the next scene seamlessly.
Wow.
So, yes, I loved that show so much.
And that's written, those directions are written into the play?
Well, the idea is written into the play, but the way in which you carry it out is not.
Ooh.
So that was exciting.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Because then you can... Because there's this balance of how important are these people, and do each one of these people in black, do they have their own character? How do they react to certain characters in the play? There's this one moment where the one character is finally going to break off the romance with the other, and I thought, wow, it should only be guys on stage. So it was only men on stage, and they all looked at him like approvingly.
Yay.
And he looks for his umbrella, and one of the guys actually has it in his hand. He has it. The other guy's on a platform, and he throws it up in the air. He catches it, pops it open,
ooh.
And he goes, and that's the end of that. And he walks off stage, and everybody really enjoyed the toss of the umbrella. It was great. It was nice.
Moment.
I am single, and I'm proud.
Yes, all right. Yes. I am man, hear me roar.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, so I can see how much you enjoyed it.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so talk to me about whether you have developed yet a feeling about what's important about being a director, how to direct, any particular tools or techniques that you particularly like.
Well, fortunately, and also unfortunately, I'm very young.
Yes, I know that.
So I...
Do you want to tell us how young you are?
I am 23 years old. Very old. Very old, though. And I think that's a strong 23, I think.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, isn't it? Age can be assessed in so many ways,
yes,
right?
Yes.
And the number is only one way in which we can assess age.
Yes,
right?
You're right. We all do different things with those years.
I think that's correct. And also, for me, the whole idea of how old anybody is and what they've done with their life or what they can do with their life, it doesn't mean a thing. So.
My approach to directing.
Yes.
So far, my belief is there are three ways. Well, there's a scale, and I forget what it's called. But there's the director who performs the piece in its original form.
Ah.
So if you're doing Shakespeare, then he wants those two columns. He wants those three entrances, those three doors. He wants the sheet that covers the middle entrance. If he's doing Greek, he wants some peridos, and he wants
What's a paradose?
Oh, they're the entrance points, the paradoi, I guess.
Oh, para, as in?
As a pair of...
As in para.
Yes, a pair of entrances. He wants the skine, which is the house wherein the actors change and they come out of. And he wants an arena. Like, that is what that kind of director wants. And then on the completely other side, which where they were doing in the 60s, was a lot of... Yeah, it was a lot of, I'm going to get the play, and then I'm going to take, I think I like this scene, and I like this scene. Oh, you know what? It's kind of like this play. So I'll get this scene from this play and smash it in, and it feels like this here. And that's beautiful, too.
Right.
It's interesting. It's entertaining. And then there's the middle ground, where I think a lot of directors live, and a lot of good directors live, is this... you understand where the piece originated and what it's about, but you also understand that you have to present it maybe in a different way or in a way that your audience will understand and understand the feeling that was here way back then and to bring it to the now. And so that's when you get, I think that's where Yentl is, exactly.
Tell me.
About Yentl?
Yeah. Can you apply that to this?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah,
oh,
please.
Oh, definitely. Mm-hmm. So Yentl was produced, what, in the... here, let me see. I can give you the exact day, because I brought the script. So Yentl was produced in 1975, October 23rd, 1975, at the Eugene O'Neill Theater. And it did well, I suppose. It did okay.
Yeah.
And... but we're producing it now in 2012, and so we have manipulated the script a bit. We've taken away all of the kind of asides, kind of, instead of... So I said to him, why don't we... We've taken away all of that, and we changed it to, why don't you...
Right. It's just the dialogue.
Yes, it's just as much as we possibly could, because there's more of a sense of urgency.
Yeah.
We've also added... music to it. It dips its foot into the pool of musical. Just because I think the definition of a musical might be an arrangement of music where that drives the action, that helps the action. I think one of the first musicals to do that was Oklahoma. That it wasn't music just to be pretty. And this music is there to drive the action, even though the actors don't ever sing. It's a band that sings. So we got this band, and we got Jill Sobule, mm-hmm. as you must know,
yeah.
to write the music. And so during pivotal points in the play, it's heightened with this contemporary rock, Jewish rock, bluesy music that gets you jumping and... They're very catchy songs.
Mm-hmm.
They are so catchy.
Okay, so the intent of this production mm-hmm. is to be in the middle, which is to say, to merge the feeling, the tone, the intent of the original.
Yes.
And to bring it somehow to a modern audience.
Yeah, to a
audience.
Contemporary audience.
Right,
yes.
right.
And I think especially with this play, I think we're trying to get, to invoke the younger audience. With
yes.
it, and somehow still keep the older built audience that's here at the Oslo that supports the theater.
Yes. Yeah, it's really interesting because this audience is not young.
No.
And yet, the theme of Yentl is for the young.
Yes, I think so.
Oh, yeah, well, there's no question about it. I mean, it's the not that many older people are trying to defy convention.
Yes,
right. You know, I mean...
If the older people, they set the convention.
Yes,
that's
right,
how they like
that's
it.
That's right.
It's
and,
safe.
You know, and I mean, some of us are, but not a lot. No, it's the truth. That's not traditionally the role... traditionally mm-hmm. the role of defying convention, of proving that the way they always did it isn't the way it needs to be done, is the role of the young.
Yes,
you know?
It is.
So this is a play for essentially, for the young. Yes. And only, it seems to me, to remind those who are no longer young, you know, that this is an important thing to value, you know.
Yes.
Okay, so this is really interesting. I've never heard anybody describe the three ways of thinking theater, of directing before. So for you personally, is there anything else that, I'm assuming that because of the way you described it, that you see yourself in sort of in the middle?
I do see myself sort of in the middle.
Right.
Definitely. I think that's where the meat is. That's where the, that's where you can get, I think, most of the audience. And I mean, if you go to England, mm-hmm. or if you go to Greece, you can see plays originally how they might have been performed.
Right.
And that seems invaluable.
Yeah. Right.
That's amazing. You must have to do so much more research to do it that way.
Unless you grew up on it.
Mm-hmm. That seems great. And over here on this other side where it's a completely, I think it's called the auteur. They're creating, they're the author of this new piece that's never existed before.
Right.
And that's incredibly creative. And I think this show is probably closer to the auteur than the original piece.
Really?
Yes, because Gordon picked up the script and he knows what the story he wants to tell. And the play seems to be a vehicle for his feeling and his creativity. This is not the Barbra Streisand.
this is not your Barbra Streisand.
And this is not the 1975 play.
Wow.
It's neither of those. And it's exciting to be in the rehearsal room and for things to happen and for the music to just work so seamlessly with this play that when this play was born, had no idea that it would reach this point.
Yes, and actually, maybe even Jill wasn't born when this play was born.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Okay, all right. So the other thing I ask people is, having spent as much of your life as you have dedicated to this work, which is really theater, either acting or directing, and to be looking forward to a life which will contain a lot more of this, mm-hmm. do you have anything to say about what that's like?
I think it's an adventure. I think it's both scary
mm-hmm.
and exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's hard to remember that we only get to live once mm-hmm. because we get caught up in making sure that we're okay, that we're okay financially, that our families are okay, that
we're safe.
That we're safe. Safety. And safety's fine. Safety's good. If I didn't have safety in my family, I wouldn't be doing this now. I think, I forgot what president said it, but they said, I studied war so that you, my son, could study politics, so your son could study art.
Oh, I've never heard that.
You should look it up. It might be Madison, might be Monroe.
Wow.
It was one of the four forefathers. He said that, and I think, he studied war. And my family, they studied work.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And I get to study art because I live in such a nice country mm-hmm. and I had such a nice family and I was safe to do it.
Yes.
So I realized early on that I'm safe. And so if I fall, there are other things I can do.
Yes.
But sometimes when I don't have work, and I need $200 extra to pay the rent, I think, maybe I shouldn't be doing this.
Yes.
Maybe I should be a doctor. Maybe I should be a lawyer. But the fulfillment isn't there. I wake up every morning excited to go to work. And I think that helps to push me along to this adventure.
It's an interesting dichotomy to have opposing needs, you know, then what you're describing and we're talking about is the need for safety,
yes.
as and contrasted to the need for passion,
yes.
maybe,
yes,
you know,
yeah.
and choosing to choose the need for passion, until until you're
the
so unsafe.
The passion gets you in trouble, yeah.
Until you're so unsafe that you have no choice. I think that's actually a fair description about of how most people survive the arts in our country.
Yeah.
Because it isn't safe.
And what's funny is, I think America's number one export is entertainment.
Yes, it's ironic, given that, how we don't honor it.
No, we don't.
No.
If I've always gotten like what are you going to school for? Theater. Oh, what are you gonna do with that?
Yeah, right.
How are you maybe I'm good at it.
Right.
We'll see.
Right.
But you always say, I don't know, we'll see.
You know, I interviewed all the people in Bonnie and Clyde, and Jeremy, you know who Jeremy Jordan is? He was Clyde.
Yes. Right. There's a picture of him in my apartment.
Yes. Well, he said that, you know, he was going to school, and people said, you know, what are you doing? And he said, I'm an actor, and, you know, yeah. He said, and then I got on Broadway. And suddenly everybody wanted to know about it, talk about it, oh great, oh good, oh, you know. Mm-hmm. He said, but until then, you know, I had to defend it.
Yes.
You know, right. And I think, you know, I talk about this a lot, the way in which we don't honor the arts, not just actors, musicians, directors, fine artists, dancers, you know, but what are you going to do for a living? You know,
exactly.
Right.
Yeah. It's a hobby.
It's a hobby, right. We play. Mm-hmm. We play at it, right? But no. The passion for those who have it is enough.
Yes.
You know,
I think if you want it enough, if you really, really, really want it, then you don't mind having an extra job and trying to make this your professional job. You don't mind getting 5 hours of sleep for a couple of months so that you can do that. You don't mind working really long hours when you don't want to because it's what you really, really want.
That is a perfect place to stop. Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. It was so much fun.
That was great.
If you really, really want it, then you don't mind the difficulty, the inconvenience, the struggle. If you really, really want it, that could be a way of talking about who you really, really are. That if you're deeply connected to who you really, really are, then you understand that there may be difficulty, inconvenience, struggle. But the being who you really are is worth it. In my book, When You Can, You Will, I have a whole chapter dedicated to, or in fact titled, The Price and the Payoff. And I talk about the fact that I believe there is virtually no payoff that doesn't come with its price. Here we have Clyde talking about the price of the passion for theater. That if you really, really want it, you understand there'll be a price. There'll be financial insecurity. There'll be many, many nights with not enough sleep. There'll be doing jobs that you don't particularly want to do. But because you will be getting what you really want, you're willing to pay the price. So, I have talked in so many shows about recapturing who you really are, a part of you which you have denied, and how the recapturing of aspects of ourselves makes all the difference in terms of the life that we live, the satisfaction that we derive, the ability to be in sync with ourselves, the comfort that comes from being yourself. But I never want to forget to say that if you've denied a part of yourself, if you don't have access to your assertiveness, to your sense of humor, to your capacity to depend or to appear weak or to use to ask for help. If you've been in denial for, not had access to any of those and dozens of other qualities which we are capable of denying, that there's a very good reason for it. You didn't do it haphazardly or casually. You did it in order to fit in order not to be teased, neglected, ostracized, punished, abused. And when you recapture, when you discover that aspect of yourself for which you have had to be in denial, there will be a price, almost certainly. And again, I find myself talking about the book. In the book, again, it's When You Can, You Will, Why You Can't Always Do What You Want to Do and What to Do About It. I talk over and over again about the deal that we make with the people who raised us, and then, because we think this is the truth, with the people who are currently in our life, the deal that we make to pretend that we are not this. So that when you begin to consider that there's a part of you that you have lost, well, put aside, believe me, there will be people who will not be happy to see the recovery of that aspect. And there will be a price. And as Clyde says so clearly and beautifully, you have to be willing to pay the price to get the thing. So, if you are considering, if having listened to this show or any of my other shows or something that had nothing to do with me, you suddenly wonder if there's a part of you that you've been in denial for, if you can feel it actually sort of leaping up and down inside of you, if you've seen it sneak out at times when you're not so good at dissembling, and you want to recover it, you might get some help from the book, and you can go on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynnshow, thelynnshow.com. Don't leave the E out of Lynn. You get another Lynn. You can go up on my website. You can click on Email Me and ask me for the book or the workbook or the audiobook. I am pretty sure there's even a place on the website for you to listen to the beginning of the book. If you want to work more proactively on that, I currently do all of my practice on the telephone. So I have clients all over the world. Some of you are listening right this second. I wrote an article called Psychotherapy on the Go. You can read about what therapy on the phone is like. And if you're interested in that, go up on the website, thelynnshow.com, click on Email Me, and tell me you're interested in therapy, and I'll get back to you. This is also true if you have any questions. If you want to listen to any of the shows that I've done previously, they're all up on the website. Need I say it again? thelynnshow.com. There's all kinds of stuff on the website. So, and with the other thing you can do by going up on my website is get access to Josh Hackney, who I say every week is my IT guru, who is the guy who has built this computer, found me this software, taught me to use it, comes to the rescue when I no longer remember how to use what he taught me, downloads, uploads, he does everything. And lots of the time he does it on the phone, like me. So if you want me or you want Josh, please go up on my website. If you use any of the social media, Twitter, Facebook, LinkedIn, we're on all of them, and please, if you like the show, go up on one of them or all of them and say that you did. That would help me a lot. If you are listening to the show, I have become completely interested in who and where you are. So if you could email me again and say who you are and where you listen, that would be also terrific. So as always, truly as always, I hope you have gotten something from this show. If you have listened to Clyde and seen that at 23 he wants this and is willing to pay the price, even though he knows the insecurity of this and has backup. And it's quite clear from listening to Clyde that if he decides he wants to be a neurologist or a lawyer, he'll pay the price for that. Because, luckily for Clyde, he's had a history that suggests that he can do what he wants. He can be who he is. That's what it takes. The security to believe that you can be who you are. And we all deserve that. So if you didn't get it, you can still get it. Okay, so I'm hoping that you got that from this show, or even that you just learned something about directing, which I did, or even that you just kind of enjoyed it because he was so much fun. In any case, I hope that you got something that will bring you back, because as always, I will be here next week, same time, same station. And you know that I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you say my face and figure have both seen better days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I just keep returning like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage, let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, hell, but I still got some tang. So you won't hear me simper. I may have gotten